Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 26, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society Practice Group's teleforum. Today, we'll be discussing Maryland v. King, the Supreme Court case argued this morning concerning the collection of DNA from arrestees. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from our expert of about perhaps 10 to 20 minutes, first 5 to 10 minutes on background on the case, and then another 5 to 10 minutes describing what happened at oral argument. Mr. John Elwood is a partner at the Vinson & Elkins Law Firm. He has considerable experience litigating in the Supreme Court and the Federal Courts of Appeals, and has substantial knowledge on constitutional, criminal, administrative, employment, and environmental issues. During his government service, among other things, he was an ex officio member of the U.S. Sentencing Commission and a member of the Advisory Committee on Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. And with that, Mr. Elwood, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Very good. In April 2009, Alonzo King was arrested and charged with first and second degree assault for allegedly pointing a shotgun at a group of people. The first degree assault charge was later dropped, but while it was pending, it qualified King for DNA testing under the state of Maryland's DNA Collection Act. Although King did not dispute his involvement in the assault, state personnel swabbed the inside of his cheek to collect a DNA specimen, sent it to a private lab for matching, and stored the resulting profile in the state database. Nearly 4 months later, his DNA was matched to an unsolved 2003 rape. The first-degree assault charge that qualified him for DNA testing was later dropped, and he pleaded guilty to second-degree assault, an offense that would not have authorized DNA sampling under state law. But based on the DNA test, King was charged with first-degree rape, convicted, and sentenced to life imprisonment without possibility of parole. Every state and the federal government collects DNA from persons who have been convicted of certain felonies, and the constitutionality of such statutes has routinely been upheld by the courts. Maryland is one of a growing number of jurisdictions, 27 states and the federal government at last count, that requires the routine collection of DNA samples from people arrested for specified serious offenses. Maryland's DNA collection statute contains several procedural protections that others do not. The DNA is not tested until after there has been a judicial determination of probable cause, and if the person is not convicted, the DNA sample is destroyed. But any identifications that happened during the interim before it was destroyed can still be the subject of prosecution. Maryland's highest court, the Court of Appeals, previously had upheld the constitutionality of the Maryland DNA Collection Act as applied to convicted felons. But in King's appeal, it said that it would not countenance application of the act to arrestees. The court said that the state had no need to identify King since it had already identified him, and had no need for a DNA sample to be confident who it had arrested. While agreeing that the buccal swab, as they call a swab from the inside of the cheek, was a minimal physical intrusion, the court said that it would not turn a blind eye to the, quote, vast genetic treasure map, unquote, that remains in the DNA sample retained by the state, and emphasized that King, as a mere arrestee, was covered by the presumption of innocence. Chief Justice Roberts, as circuit justice, entered an order staying the Maryland Court of Appeals opinion while the state's cert petition was pending, concluding, among other things, that, quote, given the considered analysis of courts on the other side of the split, unquote, that is including the Third and Ninth Circuits, quote, there is a fair prospect that the court will reverse, unquote. As my Volokh conspiracy colleague Orrin Kerr puts it, the party's positions embody two fundamentally different approaches to determining reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment. The first is that a search is reasonable only if it's made pursuant to a warrant or a specific exception to the warrant requirement. The second is that whether a search is reasonable must be evaluated on a case-by-case basis by balancing the government interests against privacy interests. Before the Supreme Court, Maryland portrays DNA testing as basically a follow-on to fingerprinting, a simple matter of identifying a recent arrestee and one that employs the most accurate method available. The state argues that a cheek swab is a minimal intrusion and that the DNA profile is not a significant infringement because, by law, the only information the state can test for in the DNA sample is the arrestee's identity, and the state only looks to a limited number of loci, or parts of the DNA, on the arrestee's DNA that were specifically chosen because they are not associated with any known physical or medical characteristics. They are so-called junk DNA. The state argues that arrestees have a diminished expectation of privacy because of their relationship to the state, just as the court has found probationers do, and the presumption of innocence simply allocates the burden of proof at trial and has no application here. The state notes that the Supreme Court has consistently held in various contexts that people have no expectation of privacy in their identity. On the other side of the equation, the state notes that DNA profiles provide unparalleled accuracy in identifying convicted offenders, and DNA makes it impossible for arrestees to successfully lie about their identity. And testing both furthers the state interest in setting appropriate bond and pretrial detention conditions, that is, people suspected of other serious offenses presumably will not be bonded out and they won't be put in cells with vulnerable people. And it also serves the state interest in solving cold cases. They note statistics suggesting that 70% of crime is committed by only 6% of criminals, and so there are a lot of repeat offenders. The state is supported by the United States as amicus curiae, as well as a large number of victims' rights groups. Before the court, King relies heavily on the absence of a warrant here and how poorly the various warrant exceptions fit these circumstances, that is, searches of parolees, special needs beyond the normal need for law enforcement, and search incident to arrest, he argues, are all inapplicable here. He emphasizes that unlike fingerprinting, DNA testing is really less about identification than about solving unsolved crimes. King emphasizes that the state has not shown that expanding the Maryland DNA Act from convicts to arrestees is important to serve the state's legitimate interests, and argues that permitting the DNA testing of arrestees will vastly expand DNA databases, given that 12 million people are arrested each year, and that according to one study, by the age of 23, nearly a third of Americans have been arrested for something besides a minor traffic offense. The brief, which was written by a former Scalia clerk named Canon Shanmugam, apparently was written hoping to appeal to Justice Scalia to join the court's four liberals and provide King a majority. The brief appeals to Scalia's unease with balancing standards and ends by invoking Scalia's famous line from Morrison versus Olson, saying that while some Fourth Amendment incursions come dressed as a lamb, this wolf comes as a wolf. The brief also makes an apparent pitch to Justice Kennedy, playing up the prospect of what the state might choose later to do with all the DNA it has on file, including full genome profiles, familial searching, and routine collection of DNA from citizens. At today's argument, there were some surprises, I would say, in lineups or indications of sympathy. To begin with, I have to note that Justice Alito noted midway through respondents' argument, he had a very long soliloquy where he described this case as, quote, the most important criminal procedure case this court has heard in decades, unquote, because of its implications for use of a new and more accurate technique for identifying people. But with that said, right out of the gate, the state began by noting all the cold cases it had started, which I think it became rapidly clear was not the tack to take, because the members of the court seemed less interested in its use, DNA's use to solve cold cases, which is a classic law enforcement technique, and more interested in its use and more sympathetic to its use as a tool to set sort of bond conditions and things like that. She began by talking about, 225 matches that had been accomplished with this DNA from pretrial arrestees. And Justice Scalia, more angry and agitated than I have seen him in quite a while, and that's saying something, said that that proves absolutely nothing and that they could have solved even more cases if they engaged in wholesale unreasonable searches, suggesting that he was pretty sympathetic to the defendant in this case, the respondent. In addition, Justice Sotomayor was also quite sympathetic to respondent in this case. Even though the state took a cue from Justice Scalia's hostile questioning, and it rapidly started going towards or rapidly started trying to defend its use here for pretrial detention and for bond determinations, Justice Sotomayor said she had a hard time with that because Mr. King was arrested in April and his DNA wasn't tested until August, suggesting that, with a four-month lag time, it could not be routinely used for bond and bail determinations. Justice Roberts also, he is somebody who tends to ask questions of both sides, trying to keep a fairly even keel so he doesn't show his hand about which way he's leaning. He suggested the state's rationales would not limit them to cases where the state is now collecting them, which are basically violent crimes, and that their rationales would justify collecting DNA for traffic stops. Justice Kagan also expressed a great deal of skepticism about the state's effort to characterize this as DNA testing for identification purposes and bail determinations. And she said that if this was solely for purposes of identifying, you'd have something. But it looks to her, and it's true if you look to the state's public pronouncements on this and the legislative history and things like that, that what they're going for here is trying to solve cold cases, and that is a very different rationale, and that sounds much more like a classical search that requires a warrant. Justice Kagan is somebody who I think is also came across as being quite sympathetic to the respondent in this case. As the case shaped up, there were statements made suggesting that in the future, the DNA results will come back much more quickly, and it will be more available for use for routine bail and bond determinations. And she was somebody who was very much right there saying, we don't decide this case in, 5 or 10 years. We have to decide this case now. And the question is, what can you do now? The state's advocate was Catherine Winfrey. She took on a lot of water, as they say, during her argument. But happily for her side, she was supported by Michael Dreeben, who is one of the very best Supreme Court advocates and maybe the very best criminal law advocate. He got up and immediately started talking about the very limited expectation of privacy of arrestees who, because they are arrestees, are subject to strip search, they're subject to having their property inventoried, and there's all sorts of things that they have to tolerate for Fourth Amendment purposes that a person off the street can't tolerate, and that they don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in having their cheeks swabbed. One thing that he did do, and I think basically trying to give the Supreme Court a fallback position where they could win in this case, giving the court a measure of comfort, was Dreeben emphasized that we're talking about a couple of things here. We're both talking about the taking the swab of the cheek for the DNA. Then there's the testing in order to identify them, which is a very limited testing where you just test these, 13 loci, which are the spots on the DNA that are loaded into FBI database. And he suggested there would be a reasonable expectation of privacy in results of a full genome test. So that even though you had taken somebody's test for purposes of this limited purpose of identifying them, that doesn't necessarily mean that you would then be able to do the full genome test that would reveal all these sort of physical characteristics and possible medical conditions they might be vulnerable to. Dreeben relied very heavily on the fact that in short order, within basically a couple of years, he thought that that police would be able to do tests within 90 minutes, and which is something that, as I say, Justice Kagan continued to be skeptical of because a couple of years from now is not now. Justice Breyer, who seemed to be this is a further illustration of how this case makes for kind of odd bedfellows, because Justice Breyer, who is one of the court's relatively liberal justices, seemed to be very much in the state's camp on this one. During questioning, he emphasized that even though Maryland and the federal government were not doing rapid DNA testing, he noted that the briefs indicated that California, for example, was doing the tests in just a couple of days. So the technology is available even now. And he suggested that there may be cases where fingerprints would not come back as rapidly as DNA tests would. Let me see. And again, John Roberts, in addition to Kagan, was somebody who talked about, how it doesn't do them much good to have to evaluate the reasonableness of this in a future world. We have to decide it in the current world. Justice Sotomayor was, very, she characterized the government's rationale in this case as permitting the state to run rampant. She suggested that it would, the state's interest would justify DNA testing in this case, it would also likewise justify, searching their car or searching the arrestee's home. And Michael Dreeben gave his argument for why they were nothing at all alike, that this is more just a case of taking somebody whose interests in privacy are already abbreviated by their relationship with the state being an arrestee and doing relatively minimal testing. Now, for the most part, the justices did not seem all that concerned with this distinction that I noted at the outset between, sort of a rigid idea that you need a warrant unless it falls within a recognized exception to the warrant requirement versus just reasonableness analysis. Justice Kagan was really the only person who picked up on that. And she said, she expressed discomfort with what she characterized as free form analysis and free form balancing. And Dreeben argued that this was a key principle of the Fourth Amendment, which is just checking for reasonableness. Justice Kennedy did not really have many questions to ask of the state's advocate, but he asked some questions of Michael Dreeben, but they suggested that he was sympathetic to the state and the federal government's position. He said that this was like a search and it's intended to arrest, and just as you can go through the person's pockets, you can test them for DNA. And Dreeben, he didn't think that that was a very good fit, but he recognized that he wanted to take whatever lifeline he was given. And he noticed that it was bottomed on a different justification, that is to preserve evidence which is on the person at the time they arrest them, but that he argued that it was nonetheless similar because people who are arrested but know for a particular offense but know they have a bunch of other crimes that their DNA will implicate them in or that they will eventually be caught for will have every incentive to flee, suggesting that underscored the state's interest in DNA testing in order to set bond conditions. Justice Kennedy went on at great length when the advocate for Mr. King stood up, Canon Shanmugam, and he went through a litany of expectations of privacy which were abbreviated because of their status as an arrestee and having their property inventoried. They can be required to take off their clothes. They can be required, Michael Dreeben pointed out, they can be required to do TB screening and medical tests and things of that sort. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, was the only person who really emphasized the fact that all of us are shedding our DNA constantly. We can't help it. Everywhere we go, we leave our DNA behind. And he suggested that we don't have an expectation of privacy in our DNA when we leave it around everywhere. He noted that if an arrestee has a drink of water, he's going to leave his DNA on the lip of the cup from where his lips touched it. And that was where Canon Shanmugam argued, the point sort of made by Michael Dreeben, except he set the line earlier. Whereas Dreeben said that you have an expectation of privacy in full genome testing, Shanmugam argued that you would have a further expectation of privacy, not just in your DNA. They can't do whatever they want with your DNA. They would need, it would require essentially a warrant in order to test it. Justice Alito, who is a former U.S. attorney and a very extensive experience with the criminal justice system, suggested in his questioning that it was a bigger intrusion to seize someone's hand in order to roll fingerprints than it is to just swab their mouth, which is a fairly quick and painless process. When Canon Shanmugam argued that fingerprints were much less intrusive than DNA because there was far more information in DNA, Alito noted that urine testing, they don't look to the full amount of information that a urine sample could reveal about a person. They just say, well, what is it being tested for here? And Shanmugam replied that urine tests always happen pursuant to a special needs case, drug testing of school athletes or for people who drive railroad trains and things like that. And that here we do not have a special need. This is a classical law enforcement interest. Breyer, who again was very predisposed to the state based on his questions, emphasized through his questioning of Canon Shanmugam that it was not much of an intrusion to swab somebody's cheek versus rolling fingerprints, but noted the much greater interest of the state in the accuracy because of the higher degree of accuracy you get from DNA than fingerprinting. He noted in his questioning that fingerprints and even ID photos were subject to abuse, so that didn't distinguish them from DNA in that regard. Justice Kennedy, in his questioning of Mr. King's lawyer Shanmugam, one thing he really emphasized was the state's interest in keeping a person in custody, this was something that the Chief Justice John Roberts backed him up on, talking about how the DNA can be used for making these sort of bond determinations. Kennedy emphasized that most people, their cases are pending for more than 4 months. And so even though it took the state quite a lot of time in order to test this guy's DNA during that time, it nevertheless would have been useful in setting his bond conditions. They could have, if he had been bonded out, they could have revoked his bond based on that. Justice Alito also emphasized, he tried to play down the time lag, saying that even though in the past it took forever to make fingerprint matches because they had to be done manually, there was no indication that that was considered to be a Fourth Amendment violation because of the time lag. Justice Sotomayor, who in past cases has worried a lot in her opinions about the information that we expose to the public through our interactions online and using various new technology, she thought that she expressed in her questioning of Mr. Shanmugam that DNA is inherently much different from fingerprinting because of the information that it turns over. So this is something that is obviously going to be, very important in her resolution of the case. During the rebuttal argument of Ms. Winfrey from the state of Maryland, John Roberts again questioned her, saying that, for all their emphasis of the fact that she said that the amicus briefs indicated that within 18 or 24 months, we would be in a world of rapid DNA testing where DNA profiles could be run in 90 minutes or so. And Roberts again emphasized that that doesn't do them very much good right now. Ms. Winfrey suggested this was just only one aspect of it, that they were still useful to bail determinations, and she cited some instances where people's bond had been revoked based on later arising DNA tests. So that covers most of the highlights of the argument. I think that you can point to certain people and say Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan and Justice Scalia all seem to be very much sympathetic to Alonzo King. Justice Ginsburg was a little bit more measured in her questioning. It was hard to read exactly where she was going. The Chief Justice asked very hard and penetrating questions of both sides. If I had to count him as a vote, I'd say he's probably going to come down on the state side. Justice Breyer and Justice Alito seemed to be very strongly in favor of the state. Justice Kennedy also seemed to be very strongly in favor of the state. So it'll be very interesting to see which way this shakes out. As usual, Justice Thomas asked no questions, and so it'll be interesting to see whether this is a case where he lines up more with Justice Alito or lines up more with Justice Scalia. And with that, I am available to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Well, thank you very much. Certainly a comprehensive review, and we certainly appreciate that. Let's go to the audience for their questions. As we do that, you should hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert, we've been listening to Mr. John Elwood, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. And while we wait for our first question, let me just review our upcoming schedule. It's a busy week in the court, so it's a busy week for us as well. Tomorrow, on the 27th, we'll have a program similar to this in the sense that it'll be from the Courthouse Steps edition, as two of our experts will attend the oral argument in the Shelby County case tomorrow. That's the Section 5 Voting Rights Act case, and host a teleforum conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. On Thursday, again, Courthouse Steps edition, the case is American Express versus Italian Colors Restaurant. That concerns arbitration agreements and class action litigation. And then on Friday at 1 p.m., we'll be hosting a teleform conference call that will discuss a comprehensive report on terrorism events, Al-Qaeda in America. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple callers in the queue. Let's go to the first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. You hinted at it, but how thoroughly was the issue explored of whether or not genetic material, however it might be collected, remains an effect of the subject that might fall within the boundaries of his zone of privacy, subject to search protection, or to what extent, because we shed DNA all the time, in fact, that material can and usually does become available for analysis and ceases to be an effect subject to protection.
I was surprised at how relatively little the court addressed that. Chief Justice Roberts was the only justice that I can recall who noted the fact that we are constantly shedding DNA, and thus there are many ways that the person could come into contact, or rather that the state could get samples. I guess Justice Alito gave an example as well of somebody walking down a street with blood on their shirt. They take it off, throw it in a garbage can, suggesting that he thought that you'd be able to get the DNA from that too. But that's not really talking about the unique thing here, which is the fact that we are all constantly shedding our genetic material. That was brought up in the answers of both Michael Dreeben of the United States as amicus and through Canon Shanmugam for King, where they emphasized that a person would retain an expectation of privacy in the full amount of the DNA. But whereas the suspect, Alonzo King, I guess now a convict, would draw that line before any testing was done for identity, Michael Dreeben suggested that while it was perfectly fine to test the DNA for purposes of identification, just the limited, the state talks about in its brief the 13 loci, but I think it's actually slightly more than that, that you would still maintain an expectation of privacy in the full genome. And that is something that I would not at all be surprised. That was made very clear to the court. And that, when they're writing the opinion, even if they vote for the state of Maryland, I would expect to see something in the opinion or in a concurring opinion emphasizing that there may be a further expectation of privacy in the full genome, even if the state has your DNA on file.
And just to be clear, this is Dean Reuter, the state, from the samples it's been collecting, is able to examine the full genome. It just forbears. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. That's something that that Canon Shanmugam played up, where he sort of mockingly said that it was basically the state was just saying, trust us. And that is because they have enough of a sample on file, they would be able to test for everything. They would be able to do the full DNA profile and be able to tell you, every single gene in your long DNA strand. But one thing that the state emphasized in its briefs is that is not the testing it does, that it is only authorized by law to perform certain tests on it. And because of the limitations on the types of tests it is allowed to perform, it is only able to get the identifying information, which is the stuff that is used for the FBI database. It is slightly more than 13 is essentially the equivalent of a fingerprint, but I understand that they may collect a couple other locations for things like, which I think allows them to tell the race of the individual arrested.
Interesting. Again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have two callers in the queue at this point, and then our phone lines will be open. Let's go to the next caller.
Hey, John. Mary Beth Buchanan here.
Hey, how are you?
Good. I have two quick questions for you. Did any of the justices ask the lawyers if they could anticipate any incursions that would be unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, sort of moving from the, you know, prior opinions, fingerprinting is okay, you know, DNA may be okay, drawing blood may be okay. Was there any type of questioning along those lines? And second, are you saying that you read Justice Alito's comments that this is an important, most important criminal case because of how important DNA sampling is for law enforcement versus how important it is because of the you know, wealth of information that individuals are now opened up to providing to the state?
I'll answer those in reverse order. I took Justice Alito's statement as being he thought that it was important just because of its use essentially as a modern day fingerprint, as a 21st century fingerprint, because it was so much more accurate than fingerprints, and because, as the state's lawyer put it in her rebuttal, there are just so many types of crimes where you can't solve them through a fingerprint, but you can solve them through DNA, such as rapes and things like that. And so I think basically his point was, you know, this is the 21st century's fingerprinting case, and it's going to be decided here one way or the other, for good or for ill. As far as other types of violations, there was surprisingly little on that, perhaps because Michael Dreeben sort of nipped it in the bud by saying that arrestees may retain an expectation of privacy in the rest of their genes. There was not much in the way of, you know, talk, for example, of familial profiling, because that is something, you know, there's a limited ability, from what I understand from people who practice in this area, that there's a limited ability to test for family connections. You know, they might be able to identify, you know, your parents from an arrestee sample and things like that. But there really was not much talk. There was not much parade of horribles other than things that were much more far afield, such as the idea that if we can take samples of DNA from arrestees, why can't we, you know, search their homes? So there was surprisingly little on the parade of horribles front.
Thank you.
If you have a question for our expert, John Elwood, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one more question in the queue at this point, and then our lines are open.
Hi, my name is Billy Freeland. I'm a student at NYU Law, and I just came in a little bit late, so forgive me if I missed this earlier, but my understanding of the facts were that King was charged on first-degree and second-degree assault. The second one was maintained, and that's a misdemeanor rather than a felony, and I'm wondering, since the misdemeanors are not covered under the Maryland Act, is there any way the court might rule in a way that distinguishes felonies and misdemeanors to suggest that it would be unconstitutional if the charge is a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony? Is there anything you can comment about that?
It's my understanding that it is a felony, but it's not a qualifying felony. It's quite clear that the second-degree assault that he was ultimately convicted of was not a qualifying offense. I was somewhat surprised that more of that was not made. There were some of the justices who commented on that fact. But there was no sort of commentary on, you know, to suggest that the state might overcharge someone in order to get their DNA into the system. But I did not get the sense that there was much appetite for using that as a way of getting rid of this case or resolving this particular case without answering the full question. I think that there is some concern that, as I mentioned during my wind-up, my preliminary talk, that the DNA, the Maryland DNA statute is actually fairly, it's narrower than that of many other jurisdictions, including the federal government's. And so I think the federal government very much wants to have a resolution of this case, which gives them a measure of protection. But I think that there is, that is something they're sensitive to. I didn't hear any of the questioning during argument today, though, that picked up on the ways in which the Maryland statute was narrower. And thus, I don't think that they're going to go off on anything that's particular about the Maryland statute. That said, there's certainly been instances where I've been surprised by outcomes of cases. You know, since we have the argument of the Civil Rights Act case tomorrow, I did not see the court's ultimate resolution in the Northwest Austin case in the oral argument of that case. So you cannot always tell the outcome of a case based on the questions at argument, but based on the questions of argument, I don't see them going off on anything particular about the Maryland statute.
We've got another caller question at this point. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Roger Candelaria. This is a great recap summary. I really appreciate it. It sounds like from the language that you used, that you related that they were using, like the constitutional provision must read something about reasonable expectation of privacy. But in fact, in the Fourth Amendment, it's that a right to be secure in one's person shall not be violated. And I just wonder, this may not be the case, but have the words reasonable expectation of privacy somehow superseded the wording and perhaps the intention of the drafters of the Fourth Amendment?
Oh, well, I think it maybe it was Katz that did that, the telephone booth case. But definitely very much. I mean, there were some people who emphasized the fact that that searches will not be conducted except unreasonable searches will not be conducted. But that has in considerable degree when they're trying to put content or give content to what is reasonable. The court has spent a lot of time over the last 50 or 60 years talking about reasonable expectations of privacy and determining what is reasonable. But there was one thing that really did surprise me, given how much the court has talked about over the years, the need for a warrant or the presumptive need for a warrant and how searches that are warrantless are presumptively unconstitutional. I was surprised by the degree to which the court was fairly relaxed about the state more or less talking openly about just balancing. And I thought that when Michael Dreeben, during his presentation, spoke at some length about the balancing of the needs of the or the interests of the state versus the interests of the individual, I thought that would have been another good example or another good opportunity for Justice Scalia to come over the bench, since he generally hates unmoored balancing or ad hoc balancing, but he didn't. Really, it was only Justice Kagan who talked about, how ordinarily you either have to have a warrant or a specific exception to a warrant requirement. And I think it may be because because there is a fair amount of agreement among various members of the court that this is like fingerprinting. And I think that a lot of people would believe that you don't need a warrant in order to do fingerprinting.
Thank you.
Final call for questions. If you have a question for our expert, John Elwood, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting, John, let me see if I can get you closer to making an absolute prediction. I think you've, by my count, you have on King's side Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, and Scalia firmly on the side of Alonzo King. And I think firmly on the side of the state, you have the Chief and Justices Breyer, Alito, and Kennedy, leaving Ginsburg and Thomas as the unknowns in the middle. Is there anything in Justice Thomas's earlier jurisprudence that points you in one direction or the other with regard to this case?
You know, I find it very hard to read. You know, he is more of an originalist than he is very much an originalist, and for that reason, I might think that he'd be more inclined to line up with Justice Scalia. And there are certainly cases like Bajikagian, which was the fines, excessive fines case, where he has, you know, ruled for the accused, or at least ruled against the state. But I do find it very hard to predict which way he's going to go on this one. You know, the overall feeling that I came away from the case with was that I thought that the state was, you know, more likely. My gut instinct was the state was more likely to win this one. But, you know, honestly, I did not even count noses before reaching that conclusion. That was just the general sense I got walking away from the argument.
Looks like we do have one more caller question. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley. To the extent the court was analogizing DNA samples with fingerprinting, was there any discussion about whether or not in the numerous cases where fingerprints are now required as part of, for example, practicing licenses, perhaps even for a gun permit, that type of thing, but all the number of cases where fingerprints are required, was there any discussion of whether or not it would be expected to be reasonable that DNA samples would also be required as well in the future?
No, there was not. Although I think there's probably, I guess that for some of those requirements, they would be compelled by the state. But no, there was definitely not any sort of discussion of, you know, other possible parades of horribles where if this is permitted, whether the state will require them for other purposes. I mean, I guess there were, you know, from the outset when they were saying, what about just picking people off the street, because they said that the state's rationales, they said, would support that. But there really wasn't much discussion looking down the road of DNA tests being used for other fairly routine matters that the state has a hand in, such as bar licensing. Because it really is true that fingerprints are used for a, you know, extraordinary array of things nowadays. So if every place where you were asked to give a fingerprint, you were required to give a DNA sample, that really would be something. I have a foggy recollection of being asked to give a fingerprint for some standardized tests even.
Yeah, I think that's pretty routine now for SAT tests even.
Mm-hmm.
At that level. It looks like we've exhausted questions from the audience. Let me give you a chance to express any final thoughts or wrap up if you want to.
Well, the only thought I will have is to end where I started the discussion of the oral argument. It was with Justice Alito's comments that this really is a very important criminal procedure question about a very basic issue. Both sides were very well represented, and so the arguments do seem to be squarely before them, and I'll be very interested to see where the court winds up. As I say, my gut instinct is that the state will win this one, but I've been surprised before.
Terrific. Well, maybe we can have you back at that point in time when we get a decision in the case. Until then, I do want to thank you, John Elwood of Vincent & Elkins, for joining us today and certainly for attending the oral argument and giving us such a thorough report. To our audience, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on this same number, when we'll be discussing the oral argument in tomorrow's case, Shelby County. That's the Section 5 Voting Rights Act case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.